This episode of The Recap was first broadcast on the 7th of March 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Daniel Giacopelli, and welcome to The Recap, our brand new show bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs right here on Monocle 24. Over the next 30 minutes, we'll be bringing you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, and The Monocle Daily, featuring coverage from our studios and our correspondents around the world. Coming up, we look back at this week's protests in Moscow.
Putin, if he's behind this, has blundered. In mafia killings, you isolate the zone, you isolate the victim, and you put distance. This is right by the Kremlin. This is just the day before a march.
More from our discussion on the murder of Russian opposition politician Boris Nemtsov a bit later. Also ahead...
They bit off a lot more than they can chew. What they wanted was a seat at the table. They didn't want to have all of the power because I think the Houthis are aware that they can't really rule all of Yemen.
We take a look at the ongoing crisis in Yemen. And writer Steve Frazier discusses his book, The Age of Acquiescence. And our technology correspondent sends us his views from the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. All that and much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Daniel Giacopelli. Now, last Sunday saw huge protests in Moscow following the murder of Russian opposition politician Boris Nemtsov. The story dominated front pages around the world. On Monday's edition of Midori House, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck was joined by John Everard, the UK's former ambassador to Uruguay, Belarus, and North Korea, and by Robert Fox, defense editor of the Evening Standard newspaper here in London. Andrew asked, could this be a turning point in Russian politics?
I think it's possible that it might be. I think that Putin, if he did order this killing, and of course everybody has a different theory about this, has scored a massive own goal. The killing goes ahead, Putin has to condemn it, and if you condemn a killing, you cannot then ban a march to mourn the victim. So tens of thousands, some say 50,000, I've seen estimates as high as 70,000 people on the streets of Moscow, almost all hostile to the government. And as Russian opposition figures have been saying on the media during the day, this is typically what precedes the fall of dictatorships. I think Nemtsov may actually prove more dangerous to Putin dead than alive.
Robert, do you think that's true? We see it. Maybe if there's even 70,000 people marching, I see some figures as low as 20,000 today. But the fact is, Putin is just so skilled at playing the nationalist card that if you're seen as, you know, believing, you know, Nemtsov was killed by himself or by another Russian, you're seen as a traitor. He's already kind of saying it's the work of outside agitators.
I disagree with you. Putin, if he's behind this, has blundered. As John was saying, in mafia killings, you isolate the zone, you isolate the victim, and you put distance. This is right by the Kremlin. This is just the day before a march. If it's a terrible blow to Putin. Look at the universal coverage, not only in Western media, but across global media. And the words of Nemtsov live on. I agree with John. I get the sensation that Putin is in real trouble. Putin probably isn't directing the action in eastern Ukraine. There is very strong evidence, and from NATO analysis that I've looked at, that it's the Russian army that's directing this. It's the Russian army that has command and control because it's been given a task to complete to secure this eastern area so that you have a bridge, for example, to Crimea, which means they have to get the port of Mariupol or anyway, a land bridge around the Sea of Azov. This is not in Putin's gift anymore. And I think that there's something reading between the lines as to what the foreign minister, Lavrov, as you've reported, has been saying to John Kerry today in Geneva. They are very worried about this indeed, because it's the thing that Putin always must fear, and actually Nemtsov understood this too, is that he is in danger of being outflanked to the right. It's a very, very dangerous moment. And that's why I think... probably the West is misspeaking to talk about yet more sanctions again at this moment. Actually, they've got to make sure that somehow the situation in Eastern Europe, which not only embraces Ukraine, but now the Baltics, doesn't carbonize, just completely fragment so that you get elements fighting, as we have seen a bit of it already, and nobody's really in control.
John, so all well and good, but even if we see some threat to Mr. Putin, it sounds from what Robert is saying, is there it could be an even kind of worse scenario waiting in the wings, you know, a group of military leaders who are hell-bent on kind of taking back Russian territory. Do you think actually we should be a little bit cautious before we kind of encourage too much of a push against Mr. Putin?
There was a wonderful quotation from a senior opposition figure in Russia yesterday. He said, "You only hate Vladimir Vladimirovich if you haven't seen the others." And I think there's probably quite a lot of truth behind that. Putin may be the least bad of a particularly unappetizing selection. That's not a reason for not putting pressure on him to desist from some of his more objectionable actions.
John Everard there, the UK's former man in Uruguay, Belarus, and North Korea, and Robert Fox, defense editor of the Evening Standard newspaper here in London, with Andrew Tuck on Monday's edition of Midori House. You're listening to The Recap here on Monocle 24. Time now to head to Barcelona, where the Mobile World Congress got underway this week. The world's largest mobile technology event attracts over 80,000 people, including tech rock stars in the shape of Mark Zuckerberg, alongside real rock stars like Will.i.am, who's turned his hand at designing electronic wristbands. While also in attendance was Monocle's tech correspondent, David Phelan. On Monday's edition of The Monocle Daily, Georgina Godwin and Andrew Muller caught up with David.
Wireless charging has come into play with a lot of mobile phones, and even now IKEA have got involved. Today they announced that they are building wireless charging pads into desktops and bedside tables so that you don't have the labour of plugging your phone in to charge it. Just plonk it down onto a pad and it'll charge up beautifully without it. It doesn't sound like much, but actually when you're used to that, it's a really nice extra feature to have.
What about compatibility though? Because so many devices use different forms of charging, so how can your sofa always know what phone you use?
Well, that's absolutely right, and it can't, but some of the phones now work with more and more of the standards. So the latest phone from Samsung, the Galaxy S6, works with both WPC and PMA, which are the two main standards. One of them's also called Qi, and it means that wherever you go with that particular phone, you should be able to get it to charge on pretty much any wireless charging pad. IKEA uses Qi, the WPC standard.
David, I understand that Sony have also introduced a couple of waterproof devices. Is this in recognition of an increasing problem of people dropping expensive electronics in the bath?
I think it's partly that. Yes, you can text in the bath, you can watch a movie on your tablet in the bath, not care if you drop it. But I think it's more that with tablets and phones now, it's very difficult to stand out from the crowd, and you need to have a gimmick, or they would say an essential feature. So Sony has done this with its top-end phones for some time. Now it's put it into its tablets, and now even a mid-range phone, the M4 Aqua, so that even however many of us are clumsy, we can always be sure that our phone is going to work when we take it out of the bath.
And just finally, David, what else are you seeing that's exciting?
It's a very bullish and positive show, I have to say, and it seems more popular than last year. There's a lot of people there. HTC had a surprise announcement for a phone company, which is a virtual reality headset, which seems to be an area that's really taking off. From lots of companies, from Microsoft and Samsung to Oculus Rift, are all making these headsets which mean that you see different world from the one we're really in. And the HTC one, which is a long way from actually going on sale, is already really tremendous, and they've formed an alliance with a games company called Valve, who are very popular. Gamers love that game company, and I think that if they can do it, if there really is a market for virtual reality as they think, then this will do very well.
Monocle's tech correspondent David Phelan there at the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, talking to Georgina Godwin and Andrew Muller on the Monocle Daily earlier this week. You're listening to The Recap here on Monocle 24, our look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows broadcast here at Midori House. Well, on Tuesday, there was great anticipation ahead of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's speech to U.S. Congress, in which he was expected to restate his criticism of the Americans for their ongoing negotiations with Iran over nuclear development. Coming just 2 weeks ahead of Israeli elections, many were speculating on Netanyahu's motivations. His insistence in the buildup that relations between the U.S. and Israel are, quote, as strong as ever, also raised eyebrows. That day on The Globalist here on Monocle 24, Yossi Meckelberg from Chatham House told Emma Nelson that Netanyahu's motives likely stemmed from domestic politics.
We can take the more cynical view that he's 2 weeks before elections. His standing in the public opinion polls is not great. His achievements in times in office are far from being impressive. Playing the statesman in America 2 weeks before election probably won't do him much harm.
Yossi Meckelberg there from Chatham House. And a little bit later on the briefing, Tom Edwards was joined for more on this topic by Daniela Pellet from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting.
Netanyahu, I think, sees himself as the Messiah who's tasked with saving Israel and the Jewish people. And he has had this sort of obsession with Iran as a major existential threat to the existence of Israel for the last 15, 20 years. I mean, he's consistently kept that. But I think even if we were looking at this rather forgivingly, it's clear that he's doing this for political gain at home. And the margins could be quite small in this coming election. And Likud strategists are saying that this speech could possibly get him two extra seats in the Israeli Knesset, which could be enough to put him in a position to form the next government.
So one might say in response to that, then it's rather unsurprising that he adopts this more aggressive rhetoric. Just in terms of what he's had to say, though, about the relationship with the US more broadly, he suggests that it's as strong as ever. But this Iran issue is certainly adding to pressure on both sides, isn't it, in terms of how close and how effectively they can work together?
It's not as strong as ever by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, this is a crisis. I mean, Netanyahu has not been known for his rapport with current or previous American administrations he's had to work through. But, you know, the strategic relationship transcends personal ties. It should transcend politics as well. But all of this chips away at trust. The Americans are saying that they're wary of sharing sensitive information with the Israelis because for fear that they'll leak it to their, brief for their own interests. And Netanyahu really has, I mean, this is a humiliation. You know, Obama was describing his speech now rather than a war. He was talking about it as commentary. Netanyahu's commentary, he said yesterday, which is a rather disdainful way of talking about a key ally. I mean, yesterday, Netanyahu, addressing AIPAC, took a rather more conciliatory tone. But, I mean, he could do that. It's like the birthday boy addressing a birthday party. I mean, this could be no warmer, more loving, cuddly atmosphere for an Israeli prime minister to speak out than AIPAC. This today's speech, well, I mean, he's a master orator, but he's going to have to tread a very, very, very careful line to, you know, even give you the impression of not being partisan.
So what happens next then in this relationship? Because obviously, you know, the US sights are also set on elections in 2016. There'll be, you know, new faces in the White House and a lot of new faces, one imagines, on Capitol Hill more broadly. Let's say that Netanyahu is successful, domestically at least, and as you said, this speech today could play a role in that. What does he need to do in terms of rebuilding the relationship or restoring some of that trust that you say has kind of gone missing?
Well, if the next president of the United States is a Republican, then he doesn't have to do very much. I think his ties are pretty strong. I mean, he's for all the rhetoric that it's not the Israel issue shouldn't be bipartisan, he's made it partisan. If, however, there is a Democrat in the White House, I think things will be rather more dicey. I mean, above and beyond all this, Israel and America have enormous mutual interests in security, intelligence, trade, and so on and so forth. But if on an issue like Iran, where there might be some differences, but fundamentally, America and Israel do not want to see a nuclear Iran. They've just got some differences in the way they're going about it. If this issue, where there should be a consensus, highlights such immense differences, I think that's going to be troubling for whoever is going to be in the White House, certainly if Netanyahu is sitting in Jerusalem at that time.
And that was Daniela Pellet from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting with Monocle's Tom Edwards on Tuesday's edition of The Briefing. Time now to hear from the Monocle Daily, which on Wednesday was hosted by Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. Despite the Occupy movement, which saw crowds of activists flood American streets a few years back, the spirit of resistance that ended the Vietnam War and advanced civil rights in the 60s and 70s seems to have dwindled, even as the rich have grown richer during the worst economic turbulence since the 30s. Well, a new book, The Age of Acquiescence, asks why. Its author, Steve Frazier, joined Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller live from our New York bureau on Wednesday's edition of The Monocle Daily.
Obviously, there are instances of resistance, and your reference to Occupy is one such example. It's very theatrical and explosive, but faded away quickly. And there are other instances of resistance, but compared to the civil rights movement or compared to the 19th century reaction to concentrated wealth and power, the resistance today is trivial and minimal. During the 19th century, there were mass confrontations between dispossessed farmers, exploited workers. The whole culture was up in arms in the 19th century during what in America is called the Gilded Age against the subversion of democracy and of economic opportunity by what today we would call the 1%, what was then called the plutocracy. That's all vanished, largely vanished today, despite the fact that today the maldistribution of wealth and income in America is as great or greater than it was during the first Gilded Age.
To what do you attribute the fact, though, that there isn't that much, or there's relatively less anger in America about that than there is elsewhere? I mean, there is a conventional wisdom about Americans that they don't like beating up on the rich because Americans still have this idea that one day they or their kids will be the rich. Do you think that's still part of the thing that drives Americans?
Yes, I do. It's a kind of indigenous American belief. It is part of the American promise that I, too, one day can be a titan of industry, strike it big on Wall Street, and so on. And for some people, over the course of the country's history, that has indeed been true. But what's interesting is that that belief, that faith, was also current in 19th century America. It was also current during the era of the Civil Rights Movement and the Vietnam War, but it did not, in those instances, suppress or smother dissent. And so the interesting question is, although people have always believed that in America, it's part of the American legacy, at other times in the past, they have nonetheless expressed their deep and abiding anger at wealthy, empowered elites.
When one talks about the way that people have behaved following the post-2007 crash, there seems to be a pattern of behaviour which has been reflected the whole world over, which is the poor have complained, the rich, however, have done nothing, said nothing, and have simply gone about getting richer. To what degree has the fact that those who could be toppled from power and who could be brought up short, in fact, just ignore any pleas, and that's changed the way that people behave?
Well, they ignore it, but they do more than ignore it. They also have become, I think, quite sophisticated at persuading people, especially during the last 30 or 40 years, that an American economy and society led by business will benefit everybody. What they've convinced people of is that the free market is the equivalent of freedom, freedom for everybody. And the business community in particular has become quite well organized and sophisticated about using the media, so that, for example, in the 1980s, 1990s, businessmen became the wise men, the savants, the presumably natural-born leaders of American life, when in the past that was never viewed as the case. Teddy Roosevelt, who was president of the United States at the turn of the 20th century, described these people as malefactors of great wealth. He said, "I don't admire them. I admire scientists and explorers and adventurers and inventors, not necessarily rich men, but in our culture over the last quarter century or so, these men have risen to the top and are therefore able to sustain this position, which allows them to ignore the plight of working people and indeed millions of very poor working people."
That was Steve Frazier, author of The Age of Acquiescence, talking to Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson on the Monocle Daily last Wednesday. And time now for another highlight from the Monocle Daily from Thursday, when we tried to make sense of the scandal surrounding Hillary Clinton's emails. It recently emerged that while serving as Secretary of State between 2009 and 2013, she not only used a personal email account, but she had her own internet server at her home. With the U.S. media in uproar, Clinton has asked the State Department to release all of her emails, but that could take months, which could overshadow the launch of her campaign for the presidency. Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson were joined on the line from Washington, D.C. by Charlie Clark, correspondent for Government Executive.
Previous secretaries of state have had varying degrees of personal email, and Government Executive just released a survey this week of about 400 federal employees who responded, and we found that 33% of the respondents said that people in their office use personal email. Now, there was a law passed just this past November that toughened the enforcement of what are really guidelines from the Office of Management and Budget, which is part of the White House, and from the National Archives, which strongly discourage executives from using personal email. But there are exceptions when there's a inclement weather and they use it as a way of communicating with their staff. But they're still required to eventually turn those over to the archives for decisions on which should be part of the long-term record. And that's really the other big problem with what Mrs. Clinton has done, is that she's assigned her own staff to determine which of the emails are to be released to the public, and that really goes against the way the procedure is supposed to work.
It doesn't necessarily surprise you when you hear that, when you understand just how suspicious Hillary Clinton is of the media, how well documented this mistrust is, and how perhaps any kind of sign of wanting to keep an element private is just going to be absolute fodder for the media.
Yes, and a lot of people don't understand the federal records laws, and there's a lot of people who just assume that if she's not releasing the emails, there's something nefarious or criminal, but it could also just be embarrassing. But in her defense, all the correspondence that she did, the email, is with somebody else in the State Department system, and I doubt she ever thought that the records would ever be completely secret.
Well, on that subject, dozens, if not hundreds, of people with whom she's corresponded during her tenure as Secretary of State must have known she was doing this. They must have known they were getting emails from, you know, Hillary Clinton at Hotmail.com or whatever it was. Why is this only...
You got her email account.
You know, it's a wild guess. Why is this only becoming a thing now?
Well, the New York Times ferreted the story out. You know, it has something to do with the fact that she's in a unique position, and she probably negotiated when she took the job for President Obama, having been his one-time primary opponent, that she would have some kind of special arrangement on that. I think this is all still being worked out. A lot of people want to know who advised her on how to set up the server in her own home, and what did her aides who communicated with her on that, too, are being asked by the press what exactly the return address was on the emails. And all this is going to continue to come out in detail, which just really throws off her momentum in preparing to run for president.
Is there any indication, Charlie, that anything on this server or anything in these emails is actually something that Hillary Clinton will regret having written?
Only in terms of maybe a little bit of bluntness or tactlessness, but there's no indication that there's any corruption or crime or revelations about negotiating with enemies or something that might cause a big scandal. I'm not saying it's not there, but there's no indicator so far that it is. And the Benghazi committee, which sort of gets the House investigators that many people thought had exhausted the topic, they sort of get a new lease on life in this subject. And they've asked for, I think, 300 Benghazi-related emails, and they'll get them, and they should get them. But whether they contain anything that changes the Benghazi narrative is still up in the air.
I guess, finally, Charlie, the only question that really matters, is anybody yet trying to stick a gate on the end of this?
I haven't heard the word gate yet, but... You know, it also depends on how she handles it. If she can issue a response, maybe tomorrow, maybe with some more authority and take control of the subject, it won't become a gate. But it'll certainly be a white noise over the next 2 or 3 months, because it's going to be 2 or 3 months before the State Department really releases the emails.
Charlie Clark there from Government Executive, talking to Andrew Mueller and Emma Nelson on the Monocle Daily on Thursday evening here at Midori House. On Friday's edition of The Globalist, we turned to Yemen, as Houthi rebels occupied the offices of an organization whose aim is to bring about a peaceful resolution to their power struggle with the Western-backed government. The Shia Houthis, who have support from Iran, have already taken control of the capital, Sana'a, and President Hadi, now attempting to regain control of the country from his new base in the southern city of Aden, said he wouldn't talk until he retook his seat in the capital. Ty Genright was joined in the studio by journalist Adam Barron. Adam was formerly based in Sana'a, and he's now visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations.
At this point, the occupation of the Offices of National Dialogue is just sort of the latest step. The Houthis have effectively occupied Sana'a since September in one form or another. I think now what you see is Hadi, after escaping from house arrest — he was held under house arrest by the Houthis for a good part of a month in Sana'a since he resigned the presidency — now that he's taken back his resignation and going into Aden, it's kind of taken the political deadlock to a whole new level. You have now him sort of making the steps to set up a government in Aden, certain Gulf embassies setting up shop there, the U.S. and Britain saying that Hadi is a legitimate president, whereas, you know, the Houthis have also set up shop in Sana'a with backing from, or diplomatic backing from other countries.
How would you characterize then President Hadi's grip on control at this point in time?
Well, I mean, when you're saying you're the president of the country and then you're also saying your capital is occupied, you know, and you're begging an armed rebel group or demanding or whatever them to release your prime minister from house arrest, needless to say, your grip on power is not particularly strong. What Hadi does have that the Houthis don't have is far more international support. Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states have traditionally been heavy funders to Yemen, which is a deeply impoverished country whose government is basically at the brink of insolvency right now. And Hadi still has the support of Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries, which the Houthis do not have. They see the Houthis as an existential threat,
What do the Houthis want?
The Houthis, that's a very good question. The Houthis are one of, I think, the most fascinating but also difficult to read groups in the Middle East. In my opinion, the Houthis have gotten, they've bit off a lot more than they can chew. What they wanted was a seat at the table. They didn't want to have all of the power because I think the Houthis are aware that they can't really rule all of Yemen. They have a very good base of support and a strong grip on sort of their core constituency. But the further you get out of the northern Yemeni highlands, the weaker the Houthis' grips and the less attractive they look to people there. I think what the Houthis are looking now is a way where they can save face, keep their seat at the table, but prevent civil war. I mean, as is usually the case, civil war isn't really in anyone's interest, even if it seems like Yemen is inching closer and closer to that point.
So do you think it might only take, shall we say, a gentle nudge for the Houthis to perhaps relinquish control over the capital?
Well, I think that's the issue. Is you say, we say the Houthis need to, theoretically, the Houthis need to relinquish their control over the capital. But then who's going to step in? Obviously, the Houthis were able to do this because the army basically collapsed. So for the Houthis, and for a lot of people that support them, they look at this and say, what happens? The Houthis, day one, the Houthis relinquish their control of the capital in the areas where they're in control. Day two, Al-Qaeda sweeps in. There's just a complete power vacuum. Banditry goes on because, you know, the Houthis are not, regardless of the issues with the Houthis, they have provided security. Far better than the government, for that matter.
So what is the near-term solution to the deadlock, and what is the medium to long-term solution to avoiding civil war and bringing about some kind of peaceful solution?
I think when you look at it, some sort of power-sharing deal remains in everyone's interest, every sort of main political faction's interest. The issue is, how do you get these people to the table when there's so much distrust? And they are at the table, but you know, you've had the same sort of cycle of negotiations continuing with the same faces for months and in some form, you know, 3 years now. So it's hard to see a way out, really, to be honest.
And that was Adam Barron there from the European Council on Foreign Relations with Tig Enright on Friday's edition of The Globalist. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's edition of The Recap. This show is produced by Alice Block and Toby Hammond, and I'm Daniel Giacopelli. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs right here on Monocle 24. Thanks for listening.